At this point, I'm going to introduce our speaker tonight. I was talking to a gentleman over here earlier, and he heard me tell my story a couple of weeks ago here, and he was very inspired by that. And I said, take that inspiration, multiply it by 10, and that's the inspiration I've gotten from my speaker tonight. I've seen him touch a lot of lives, and I think you're in for a real treat. The man speaks from the heart, and I love him to death. And with that, I give you Bill S.
Good evening. My name is Bill Sanders, and I am an alcoholic. And my goodness, look back there. By the grace of God, I'm sober tonight. And that's the single most important thing that I will share with you from this podium tonight, that it is by the grace of a loving God and the tender loving care of people like you in rooms like this that I have awakened for the last 9,993 mornings without a hangover. Now, I don't want you guys to spend the next hour trying to figure that out. That's 27 years, 4 months, and 10 days. It impresses me a lot more than it impresses you, I can tell you that. It is virtually impossible for me to believe that next Friday it will have been 10,000 days since I had a drink. And I'm tickled to death that it's falling on December 11th, because on December 11th, our beloved co-founder Bill Wilson would have been sober for 75 years next Friday. The miracle that happened in Towns Hospital in New York City 75 years ago next Friday was an event that literally would change the world. Many of us in this room tonight would not be alive had it not been for that miraculous event that occurred in that little hospital room in New York. I'm going to begin with a little story. It's a favorite story of mine. It's the story of a little drunk who's walking along the beach one day. And he stumbles across something in the sand and trips, and he gets up, looks down, and he finds a little bottle half buried in the sand. And he picks it up, and he uncorks it, and in a moment there was a puff of smoke. And then standing in front of him in the sand was a guy about 8 feet tall with a big turban on top of his head. Little drunk rubbed his eyes, blinked and looked again. He'd had some bad DTs in his time, but he had never seen anything like this. It spoke, "I am your genie, and you have two wishes. What is your first wish?" Well, that little drunk thought for a second, then he said, "I know what I want. I'd like to have a bottle of bourbon that's never empty." Another blink of the eye and a puff of smoke, and there sitting in front of him in the sand was a jug of booze, the best Kentucky bourbon. He picked it up, uncorked it, took a big swig of it. It was the good stuff, all right. He tilted it up and chugged at it for about 30 seconds and then tilted it down just to be sure, and it was still right to the top. He did that about 3 times. The level never went down. The genie said, "All right, how is that?" He said, "That's wonderful." He said, "All right, what is your second wish?" The little drunk said, "I want another one just like this one." Now, if you understand that little story, then you're in the right place tonight. You could go out here on South Cobb Drive and stop somebody and tell them that story, and they'd say, "Well, now, wait, that doesn't make any sense. If this one's never going..." They don't get it. And you know what? They never will. and they will never understand me. From the very earliest memory, I was a loose cannon. I didn't fit, I didn't belong. From the earliest memory I have, everywhere I went, no matter who I was with, I felt like I was on the outside looking in. I felt like everybody around me knew something I didn't know, had something I didn't have, that something was missing. I didn't know what it was, but I knew that you had something that I didn't have. And as a result of that, I ended up being a scared little boy who became the class clown to cover up that fear. At the age of 13, I went into the profession that was to be my profession for 50 years until I retired just a few years ago, and that's the broadcasting business. I became a disc jockey at the age of 13, and at that time was purported to be the youngest disc jockey in America. That record's been long since broken. Everybody assumed that the smart aleck kid on the radio spinning rock and roll records and bumping his gums was who I was. They didn't know that I was a scared kid hiding behind the anonymity of a microphone, being somebody else. And I spent most of my adult life until I arrived at the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous being somebody else. I would be whoever you wanted me to be. I became a chameleon of a people pleaser. I would read you. I would decide what I thought you wanted me to be, and that's what I'd be. I could be a Republican at happy hour. And by the time happy hour entered, I could be a flaming Democrat. I could be an atheist. I could be a preacher. I had a lot of careers when I was drinking. I was an astronaut. I was a lawyer. And I was a liar. And all of this led to the fact that by the time I arrived at the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no clue who Bill Sanders really was. I had lost myself mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. I was a lost soul. And I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous because I had nowhere else to go, and I was absolutely desperate. And for those of you who are beginning your journey in recovery now, there is nothing in the world that I wish for you more than desperation. Because out of desperation becomes teachability, and out of teachability comes hope, and out of hope comes recovery. I'll never forget my first AA meeting. It actually occurred 2 or 3 years before I got sober. I went with a friend who I had known for a long time, and he wanted me to invite me to go to an AA meeting with him, and I went. And we walked into the meeting, and I kind of sat down in the back of the room and kept whispering questions to him as to what was going on. They read all that stuff, and then they there was a woman over there, everybody kept congratulating. And I said, well, what are they congratulating her for? Oh, this is her 24th birthday. She looked a lot older than that to me, but. The end of the meeting, somebody stood up there and called her up there, and they gave her a poker chip. And then they brought out a little cake, and they put it down there and made a big deal out of it. And my friend turned around to me and said, Bill, if you won't drink for a year, we'll do that for you. I said, now let me get this straight. If I don't drink for a year, you will give me a poker chip and a little cake. Whee. I couldn't wait to come back several years later. I remember my first drink at the age of 15. Some friends said, you want to go to Carolina and get some beer and drink. I grew up in a little town in North Georgia that was supposedly a dry county. And I don't know if it was peer pressure, curiosity, or what. I said yes, and we crossed the state line into Carolina, and there's a little beer joint over there. You could pull up behind it and honk the horn three times, and guy'd come out, and if you could see over the steering wheel, he'd sell it to you. And we brought a case of what I think I remember was Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. And we came back and sat on the banks of the old muddy Savannah River somewhere about 300 feet at the bottom of Lake Hartwell, because Lake Hartwell wasn't there back then. Someone popped open one of those beers and handed it to me, and I took a big slug. And I can tell you tonight, I remember it like it was yesterday. It was the most vile, putrid, god-awful tasting stuff I'd ever put in my mouth. That's very likely why I only drank six that night. I don't need to tell most of you what happened between the second and the third beer. Suddenly, I wasn't afraid anymore. And in that instant, I was smarter and wittier and handsomer and taller and sexier than I had ever been in my entire life, or for that matter, anybody I'd ever known in my entire life. And in that night, at that moment, subconsciously I thought, I have found a friend that's going to be my friend for the rest of my life. And it darn near was. Tonight, that night, there were also set into motion a belief that I was to carry with me for 25 years. And that belief was that alcohol affected everyone the same way it affected me. I know today that is not true. Alcohol does not affect the non-alcoholic the way it affects us. It does not change their perception of reality. And every drink that they have does not demand that they have another. That also explains to me some questions that I have never, ever understood the answer to. I've never understood the person who says, no more for me, one's my limit. Ain't that the dumbest remark you ever heard in your life? But the one that really, really always got me, still does, I still to this day don't understand the person who says, no, no more for me, I'm beginning to feel it. That ain't where you quit, that's where you get going. I didn't drink that much in high school because if my Southern Baptist mother had ever caught me drinking, I would not have needed Alcoholics Anonymous, and Undertaker would have been just fine. But then I went off to college over in Athens, Georgia. I'm glad you took that jersey off right there that you were wearing. That yellow kind of gets me. Oh, he's going to put it back on. After the meeting, we'll talk about last weekend. And we won't talk about last year. I'd love to tell you some of my fond memories of my 4 years at the University of Georgia. I really would love to. But by then, I was suffering from what the folks in North Georgia used to call spells. Around here, we call them blackouts. 1961, that was a blackout. I had a lot of experiences through the years in broadcasting, some of which I can talk about and some of which I wouldn't dare. But to give you an idea of the kind of thing, I would, for a number of years, had to wake up in the morning at 5 o'clock and sign a radio station on the air and sound cheerful. Now, if you want to know what hell is trying to sound cheerful at 6 o'clock in the morning when your mouth tastes like the bottom of a bird cage and your head feels like the Russian army did maneuvers on it the night before. My radio audiences never knew how many mornings they heard me reading the morning news headlines, lying flat on my back on the studio floor with a microphone pulled down over my face, the only way I could get the room to quit going whoomp, whoomp, whoomp. Another experience I had occurred when I was working here in Atlanta at WSB Radio. One afternoon, the news director walked in and said, "Bill, we've got to get downtown and do an interview. There's nobody else in the newsroom. Grab the recorder, get in the mobile unit, and go down to the Dinkler Plaza Hotel. And here's the information." And I took the piece of paper from him, and on the paper it said, "Lyndon B. Johnson." Holy mackerel. Well, I grabbed the tape recorder, jumped in the mobile unit, started downtown, and said, "Ain't no way I can do this without a little fortification." So I stopped at a neighborhood bar, had a couple of quick shooters, went on down to that old hotel in Atlanta, and got on the elevator, went up to the designated floor, got off, was met by the Secret Service frisk, and they checked my credentials and led me into this hotel room suite. This giant of a man greeted me at the door and said, "Come on in, boy, and have a seat." I walked in, I sat down on a sofa, and he sat down on a sofa facing me, and I looked, and between us in the middle of the, between the two sofas was a coffee table, and on that coffee table there was a big jug of Jack Daniels and a couple of glasses. He said, "Before we do this interview, boy, how about let's have us a little snort?" Sounded good to me. He poured my glass full, and he poured his glass full. And we began, I should explain to you now, we began what is called the pre-interview interview. In those days, you didn't just walk in and sit down and interview the President of the United States. You had to go through this pre-interview interview to tell him what you're going to ask him, and he would tell you whether or not he's going to answer it. And we're doing that, and I'm asking the questions, and he's answering, and I'm taking a few swigs as we go along, and every time I get it down a little bit, kind of like that proverbial jug with the genie, he filled it back up to the top. And we kept talking there, and I started thinking, "God, it sure is hot in here." A few minutes later, it hit me. "My God, this man is drunker than you are." About 5 minutes later, he said, "All right, turn that thing on, let's do it." I turned on the tape recorder and we started the interview. I asked the questions, he gave the answers. Listened back to it years later and it was a darn good interview. Great questions, great answers, you'd never have known until I got to the point in the interview where I asked him a question about his wife, Ladybug. Thank God he thought it was funnier than y'all did. I can always tell the age of people in the audience. There's some faces out there going, huh? For you youngsters, his wife's name was Lady Bird, not Lady Bug. That's an example of one of the foibles of my drinking career in the broadcast world. I had to travel a lot in the latter years of my experience in broadcasting. I had to go to Washington and New York, Chicago, Los Angeles a lot. And I used to say I was afraid of flying. I've learned in recent years I never was really afraid of flying. I was afraid of falling. And I would always get out to the airport early and go to the bar and have a few drinks before I got on the plane, get fortified before that plane took off. And so I'd get there plenty of time, go in the bar and sit down, work nicely, except when I'd forget to get on the plane. Now, for a number of years, Delta Airlines, as you know, headquartered here in Atlanta, had a series of commercials, which ironically, for a number of years, I did the voiceover on those TV commercials. And my line that I had on there was their slogan, which said, Delta is ready when you are. Uh-uh. They'll leave you. I'm glad they stopped those commercials. It was a damn lie. So I do what any good drunk would do, just get on another airplane, go somewhere else. Call home that night. How's the convention in New York going? I don't know. I'm not in New York. Where are you? I'm in New Orleans. More and more often, I was waking up in strange places, strange cities, strange beds with strange people. More and more often, I was wandering bars in distant cities. And of course, one of the things I was always looking for was for the perfect right woman and for me. I knew the one I was married to wasn't the right woman. Blew that one. And I'd sit in the bar and I'd look down at the other end of the bar and I'd spot this vision of loveliness. And I would sit there on that bar stool and for about 10 minutes I would plan the absolutely, undeniably perfect pickup line ever. And I'd rehearse it over and over and over in my mind. And then I'd slip off my stool and go down to the other end of the bar and slip onto the stool right next to her. And I would look into her beautiful eyes. And she would look at me. And I would open my mouth and say to her, Eshava fali bai shaili varni. And I knew she was the right woman because she'd say, yeah. Next morning, she was not the right woman. I used to consider myself to be a classy drinker, social drinker. I know today that if you have to drink in order to be social, you're not a social drinker, and you never will be. I used to drink in some of the fanciest places in Atlanta, entertaining clients. Places where I could walk through the door and the maitre d' and his tuxedo would greet me by name and usher me into the lounge, and the bartender would spot me coming, mix my drink, and have it sitting on the bar by the time I reached it. I always thought I like taking people in to see that because I think it makes a statement. I know today it made a statement all right, but it wasn't the one I thought it was making. I was also a snob of a drinker. I'd tell you the optimum temperature for drinking vodka is 31.5 degrees Fahrenheit. I know tonight that that is not true. The optimum temperature for drinking vodka is 108 degrees Fahrenheit. Because that's the temperature underneath the front seat of my car where I kept that bottle. I also know that you're not a classy drinker if you wake up in the morning and you look down and there's dew all over your clothes. And you blink your eyes and realize you're looking out from underneath a bush in Piedmont Park. And you blink again and realize you're looking up the nostrils of a policeman's horse. There is no good answer to the question of what are you doing here, other than where is here. It is not classy, nor either is it smart when you're dragged from a car that you've planted into a steel post on the side of an Atlanta City street, and you're frisked and cuffed and put into that cage in the back of the cop car and hauled off to jail. The whole trip to the jail, I'm arguing with the cop, I can't be drunk, I'm not drunk, I've only had two beers. No way I'm drunk. Two beers, all I had. I've been convinced for years that there's this school that drunks are taken to sometime or another in their drinking career when they're in a blackout. And they're taught at that school, if you're ever stopped by the cops, never admit to more than two beers. I mean, have you ever watched these cop shows on TV? They drag a guy out of the car, he slides down the side of the car, blap, on the ground. Hey, mister, you had a little too much to drink, and all this two beers. Wife and I were watching one a couple of months ago. Guy got out of the car, fell flat on his face, got up, the cop propped him against the car, he slid down the car. Hey, fella, had a little too much to drink, hadn't you, tonight? No, I hadn't had but three beers. I went, oh, God, he missed class. But I argued with that cop all the way to the jail. I ain't drunk, can't be. He put me on that breathalyzer thing. I blew in it. It registered 0.28. Yeah, ooh. I said, now wait 1 minute. There is no way on earth I could be registering 0.28 on two beers. The cop agreed with me. I can assure you that was the only thing we agreed on that night. It is not smart, nor is it classy. In case you've never done this, don't. It's not smart to go to court for a DUI drunk. Judges don't like it. I had a friend who was a lawyer. He said, look, that was my first DUI. When you go to court, they call your name, stand up and say, how do you plead? You simply say, Your Honor, I plead nolo contendere. I said, what's that? He said, that means no contest. You plead nolo contendere, the judge will slap you on the wrist, give you a little fine, send you home. Got it. Went to court. Crocked to the gills. They called off about 6,000 names before they got to mine, it seemed like. Finally, they said, Mr. Sanders, I stood up. How do you plead? Your Honor, I plead nomens nolo needin mutton guilty. And he threw the book at me. All this time I'm drinking, my disease that I know today is a disease outfitted me with something that I didn't know I had. And it's what today I call my alcoholic blinders. You see, I thought my drinking was nobody's business but mine. It didn't affect anybody but me. Get out of my face. Leave me alone. Those alcoholic blinders were very effective. By now, I had a beautiful little blue-eyed, blonde-haired baby girl at home. Those blinders didn't allow me to see that my little girl never invited friends to come home and spend the night, because she never knew when Dad's going to come home in the middle of the night in a drunken rage, smashing furniture, throwing TV sets through plate glass windows, dragging her out of the bed, belittling her, calling her names, and emotionally abusing her terribly. Those blinders didn't allow me to see that the only look that was ever in that little girl's eyes was a look of fear and of hate and of disgust. Even when my little girl wrote in her diary, and I read it and shouldn't have, she wrote, "I wish my daddy was dead and maybe there'd be some peace in our home." But the blinders were firmly in place. My wife was a drunk, just like me. My wife and I destroyed our marriage. We had marriage counselors tell us that our marriage was hopeless, to give it up. And one day my wife decided to go to an Al-Anon meeting to find out what she could do about that drunken SOB at home. There was only one thing wrong with that. She went to the Al-Anon meeting snockered. And they really ticked her off by suggesting that she might be in the wrong room. She left for a couple of years, and then she went back one Friday night to the right room. And when she left the house, we had reached the point in our marriage where I no longer asked where she was going. She no longer asked where I was going. And we didn't care. If I didn't come home for 3 or 4 days, she didn't even ask where I'd been. So she left, and I'm sitting in my recliner chair with a bottle in my hand, staring at the TV. She's gone about 3 hours. She comes back. I'm still sitting in that chair, still holding that bottle, still staring at the TV, probably trying to decide whether to turn it on or not. And she came and stood in front of me and looked down at me and said, "Guess where I've been?" And I said, who cares? And she did something really weird. She didn't say a word. She flipped a white poker chip into my lap. And I looked at it, and I looked back at her, and I looked back down at it. And I said, "I have no idea where you've been. But if that's all you won, you had a lousy night." Well, she told me where she'd been. She'd been to an A&A meeting. And I went into an absolute flying pluperfect rage, because I knew beyond any shadow of a doubt there was no way on the face of this earth that that woman was an alcoholic. No way. Because if she was an alcoholic, then she just couldn't be an alcoholic. That's just all there was to it. But she didn't care what I thought. She started going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings. Some fool nonsense about 90, 90, and 90-something. And I kept waiting for the other shoe to fall. I kept waiting for her to say, "You need this worse than I do. You're a bigger drunk than I am." Didn't do it. Just went to meetings and went to meetings and went to meetings. Oh, there were little hints left around the house, like I'd go in the bathroom, lift the toilet seat, and there's how it works, taped to the lid. She knew where I'd see it. It was to take several more months and more arrests and more pain and more loneliness. Because you see, my best friend had become my worst enemy and my biggest nightmare. And I spent day after day trying to recapture that good old high that became elusive and impossible to get back. And on the afternoon of July 26, 1982, I stumbled into the 8111 Club on Roswell Road. And I sat down in a chair at the back of the room, and I looked around at the front of the room. Now, I don't know about the God of your understanding, but the God of my understanding has a sense of humor. Because sitting there chairing the meeting was my wife. She didn't see me until the end of the meeting, when a man got up and explained those chips. And I got up out of my seat and I took the longest walk I've ever taken in my life to the front of that room. And a man pressed a white poker chip into my sweating, trembling hand. And I walked back and sat down. I choose to believe tonight that an old Bill Sanders walked to the front of that room that night and died, and that a new one walked away. Because as I said at the beginning, by the grace of God and the tender loving care of people like you in rooms like this, I have not had a drink since that night. And I thank God every morning and every night for that. You told me I needed to get a sponsor. I explained to you I was in broadcasting. I got lots of sponsors. You said that wasn't what you were talking about. So I decided to get a sponsor scientifically. I looked around for the sweetest, kindest, roly-poliest, white-haired old granddaddy that I could find. One that I was sure would pat me on the head on a daily basis and say, I've never seen anybody work this program as good as you. And I wouldn't change a thing. Took me about 3 weeks and I found him. Snow-white hair, roly-polier than I am, a perpetual smile a mile wide, and I asked a man by the name of Doc Crandall to be my sponsor. Biggest mistake I ever made in my life. In the years that man was my sponsor, I don't remember him telling me one single thing I wanted to hear. But he told me a hell of a lot I needed to hear. I knew I was in trouble the first day. He said, fine, I'll be your sponsor. Let's discuss the rules. Rules, what rules? Nothing simple, just simple. All you got to do is when you wake up in the morning, you roll out of that bed onto your knees and you ask God, as you understand him, to keep you sober today. And the last thing you're going to do at night is get back down on your knees and you're going to thank him and then repeat it the next day. And I said, well, Doc, I grew up in a Southern Baptist church. I got a long way away from it. I know prayer is important. But I got to be honest with you, I'm just not comfortable with this knee business. He said, I don't remember saying a damn thing about you being comfortable. Well, I drew myself up. He couldn't talk to me like that. I had darn near 30 days. I said, I thought this was a program of suggestion. He says, it is. I suggest you do it or get you another sponsor. That's how we began our journey. Then he gave me that book. He was a nut about that book. He said, I want you to take this book and I want you to go home and for the next 3 weeks I want you to study. I didn't say read, I said study it. And when you've done that, after about 3 weeks, you come back, we're going to sit down and talk about how you can make those principles in the fifth chapter work in your life. I said, okay, I can do that. Stopped at the office supply place, got me some legal pads and some highlighters and some sharp pencils. I went home, cleared off my desk, I spread all that out, and I went to work. I opened that book up and I highlighted and I underlined, I made notes in the margins, I wrote notes in the legal pad. I struck through the steps that didn't have anything to do with me, and I jotted down a few I'd thought of that y'all obviously hadn't. And after about 3 weeks, I called and said, Doc, I'm ready to talk. He said, hot dog, come on over. I went over to his house. I spread all my stuff out on his coffee table. He reared back in his big old recliner chair, and he said, all right, boy, lay it on me. I opened the book up to chapter 5, and I pointed down there and said, okay, Doc, looking here at this first step, as I interpret, and that's as far as I got, boy, that step don't need your interpreting. It needs your doing. Yeah, yeah, but Doc, what I think it means is, he said, Bill, it's in English, son. It says exactly what it means, and if you look closely, you'll notice they put little numbers by those steps so smart college boys like you can follow along with us. God, he was tough. I had a personnel problem in my office one time, an employee that was just out of control. And I thought Doc had a lot more experience than I did. I'll talk to him about it. So I got to a meeting early one night and said, Doc, can we talk a few minutes? And we got a cup of coffee and walked out under a tree. I said, I got a personnel problem at work. I want to run by you and see what suggestion you got. Here's the situation. He said, hang on. I said, what? He said, what step are you working on this? I said, what? He said, what step are you working on this situation? I said, oh, no. You don't understand, Doc. This ain't got nothing to do with steps. I'm talking about some real life stuff here. He said, you go home and look again. I went home and I went down through the steps. I don't know anything about a personnel problem. Went back the next night and I said, Doc, I looked. There wasn't anything in there. Now let me lay out my situation. He said, go look again. Well, after about the third or fourth night, I'm driving home thinking, oh my God, how did I get hooked up with this crazy old bastard? But I did it anyway. I got home and I opened the book up and I went down through there. There was the answer. And over and over and over and over again, he kept sending me back to that book and back to those steps. Until one day the light went on in this thick skull of mine that there is nothing that will happen in the life of this alcoholic that the answer is in that book and in those steps. A few years ago, we came out with the fourth edition of the Big Book. I didn't think it was any big deal. Because at the time that that book came out, I was reading the 26th edition of the Big Book. Now, before you think I'm crazy, let me explain it to you. At that time, I had read the Big Book from cover to cover 26 times. And every time I read it, they have rewritten that sucker. There is stuff in there that was not there the last time I read it. I told you I'm a highlighter and an underliner. Now this over here, somebody, I don't know what that is. That's no big deal. But this wasn't in here the last time I read that book. I shared that at a AA convention out in California a few years ago, and a young woman came up to me afterwards and said, do you really believe that? I said, sweetheart, let me tell you what I believe. I believe that God speaks to me through this book. He shows himself and reveals himself to me and what I need to see exactly when I need to see it. I also believe he speaks to me through you people. That's why I go to a lot of meetings. I quite often say I pray for God's will and go to a meeting and find out what it is. God's never spoken to me through a burning bush or a bugle or a trumpet. I asked my one sponsor one time if a burning sofa counted, and he said it didn't. My sponsor used to say, you missed a great meeting last night. It was really, really powerful. I heard exactly what I needed to hear. I said, what? He said, I don't know what you needed to hear. I heard what I needed to hear. You weren't there, so you missed what you needed to hear. So I go to a lot of meetings. Even after 27 years and 4 months and 10 days, I go to a lot of meetings. Why? I don't know. Because I love them. That's why. That's where my friends are. I've been gone from the bars now 27 years, 4 months and 10 days. My close bosom buddies, my drinking pals, my lifelong friends. Not one of them has called. Not one of them has written. I suspect the majority of them hadn't even figured out that I'm gone yet. But you let me miss a couple of nights at my home group over at the Mount Vernon group in Sandy Springs, and my phone's going to ring. Are you okay? What's going on with you? Why weren't you there last night? I've got friends like I never dreamed of having. I love this fellowship. I live this fellowship. It's at the cornerstone of everything in my life. They call it a selfish program, and I guess it is, if your recovery is the number one priority in your life above anything and everything else. And in my life, it is. My recovery comes before my wife, before my child. It comes before my grandchildren. It comes before anything in my life, because if I lose my sobriety, the rest will follow. Not if, not maybe, not sometimes, it will go. My sponsor, Doc Crandall, went on a 12-step call in November of 1985 and never came home. As he and another man struggled to take a shotgun away from a suicidal young alcoholic that Doc had been trying to help get sober, the gun accidentally discharged. Doc caught the blast full in the stomach and died before he reached the hospital. He gave his life trying to save another alcoholic. That evening, I sat in his den, and I felt a loneliness come over me that I hadn't felt in a long time. How can I go on without the man who planted me in this program, who dragged me through those steps, who made me realize that my recovery depended on 100% surrender? How can I go on? And the answer in the quiet stillness of that evening came: you do it by doing what he taught you to do. And what his sponsor taught him and his sponsor before him taught him all the way back to that fateful night on May 11th, 1935, when the broken-down stockbroker and the has-been doctor sat at that little gatehouse in Akron and said, "You think we might stay sober if we help one another?" I believe with all my heart that back in the mid-1930s, God looked down in his infinite and compassionate wisdom and said, "The lowly alcoholic has suffered for long enough. He's been the outcast of the world for long enough. I've got to give him a way out." And what a way he gave us. He could have said, "Lock them up in jails and throw away the keys," as many of us were and should have stayed. He could have said, "Put them in colonies like lepers so they can't contaminate society." He could have just said, "Let them die," as many of us have and will continue to do. But instead, he gave us each other. And with it, he gave us more love and more laughter and more joy and more happiness than most of us could ever dream of in 100 lifetimes. And you'll never convince this alcoholic that he didn't do one more thing. I believe that he gave us a one-on-one, face-to-face relationship with him that few people on this earth will ever know. In the days and weeks after Doc's death, I was surrounded by the greatest little old bunch of snot-nosed sponsees that anybody could ever have. Those little boogers dragged me to meetings when I wanted to hide. They made me share when I wanted to isolate. And they loved me, and they cared for me, and they carried me until I could walk the walk again myself. And I love them forever for it. I love being a miracle because I am a miracle. The only thing that is equal to or better than being a miracle is getting to participate in somebody else's miracle. And I love doing that too. There's a man that I sponsor that I'll share with you just briefly. A number of men in this room know this young man. About 20 years ago, he had just gotten out of jail, and he came to me and asked me to sponsor him. Now, he was a young African-American dude, about 6'4 and a half. And when he looked down and said, "Would you be my sponsor?" I said, "Yeah." He had been a dope dealer and a part-time pimp on the streets of Atlanta. I see somebody nodding back there. He had gotten arrested when he tried to sell a stolen car to an undercover cop. Hauled into DeKalb County court, sentenced, served some time. Got out of jail, and he was introduced to AA behind bars, and he came out and said, "I'm going to stay sober, and I'm going to change my life." And he asked me to sponsor him. He said, "You know what I'm going to do?" I said, "No, what are you going to do?" He said, "I'm going back to finish my college degree." I said, "Good for you." And he did. And he finished college and said, "I'm going to go to law school." Okay. He went to law school and he finished. He joined a successful law firm in Atlanta. A couple of years later, he split away when he and another man opened their own law firm. And a couple of years ago, that young man was sworn in as a judge in the same courtroom where he had been sentenced. And last year, he was licensed to practice law before the United States Supreme Court. You can't get here from where he came from, but by the grace of God. I believe, and I say this especially to you people who are here in recovery, early recovery now. When you get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, you blow the lid off the possibilities for your life. You can achieve anything you set your mind to. There are no limitations. If a young African-American junkie from the streets of Atlanta can stand before the United States Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. and practice law before those esteemed justices, nothing you come up with is going to be impossible. Now, I'm going to conclude by telling you the rest of the story with my life. The little girl who wrote in her diary, "I wish my daddy was dead," some years ago asked me to walk her down the aisle of a church. And I cried all the way down the aisle. And I took her hand and I placed it into the hand of another young man and I gave her away. And I can tell you tonight, I love my son-in-law. He's a fine young man. I worried the first night we met him when my wife and I took he and our daughter out to dinner and we walked in the restaurant and the first thing he did was order a beer. And then he sat there and nursed that thing for 2 hours. I said, "Son, you ain't never gonna make it in my little outfit drinking like that." And he won't. But the greatest tears didn't come at the wedding. The greatest tears came at the reception that followed. You see, my little girl had said, "Dad, I'm going to have the first dance with Paul, her new husband, but I want to have the second dance with you." And I said, "All right, sweetheart, but you better tell me what we're going to dance to, because I need to practice with your mom, because you see, I don't dance today nearly as well as I never did." She said, "No, I'm not going to tell you." And I watched as the young prince and princess had their first dance together, and then my little girl came and stood in front of me and took my hands. And I looked into her eyes, and instead of fear and hate and disgust, I saw love and I saw respect. And she led me out onto the dance floor, and the music began. And the words of the song were, "Did you ever know that you're my hero? And everything I want to be. I can fly higher than an eagle. You're the wind beneath my wings." What a miracle had been worked in the lives of this family that had been ripped and shredded and torn apart by the insidious, relentless, cunning, baffling, powerful, and patient disease called alcoholism. And yet you people and God and this program, meeting by meeting, step by step, sponsor by sponsor, had put this family back together again. Today, I can tell you that the wife I tried to throw, my best to throw away, is my best friend. She's my soulmate, my lover, and my pal. And I can tell you tonight that she's not with me, but she's over in Roswell, Georgia, thinking about me, sharing with you, and she knows I'm thinking of her. And God willing, if we make it until the 30th day of this month, we will have been happily ever aftering for 43 years. And we owe that to you and to this program. Today, I can tell you, I'm about as happy as a man can be. Has everything been perfect for the last 27 years? No, far from it. We've been through a lot of tragedy. We've been through a lot of pain. Just last week, my wife suffered a detached retina and had to have surgery on her eye today. And for the next few weeks, she can't see anything out of that eye. But on the way to the meeting last night, she said, "Can you imagine trying to go through this without the program?" And I can't. Because you see, I don't go through anything alone anymore. I don't have to. I've got the most wonderful fellowship in the world. I've got the most wonderful friends in the world. A couple of years ago, I was bedridden for about a week and a half. Meetings were brought to my bedroom. Friends stopped by. I got calls. I got emails. Since my wife's surgery last week, we've gotten emails and phone calls and what is it they call it now? Twitters? I don't know how to twit yet, but she does. Don't quit before the miracle happens is something you'll hear around this program a lot. I change that a little bit. I say don't quit before the first miracle happens. Because they're going to come, and they're going to come, and they're going to come. And as soon as you're through dealing with one miracle, another one's going to show up. And they never stop. I can tell you, after 27 years, my life's still getting better every day. Now, some people recall themselves recovered alcoholics. I don't. I still call myself a recovering alcoholic because I'm a work in progress, and I want to remain a work in progress until the last breath I take on this earth. I don't ever want to be arrived somewhere in sobriety. I want to always stay teachable. And if I go to meetings, there's still plenty of teachers there. They may not be PhDs, they may be some teenage newcomer with 26 days who says exactly what I need to hear in a meeting. So I go to a lot of meetings. I'll end by simply saying this, and it shouldn't surprise you at all that I say it tonight. As I approach 10,000 days of recovery, did you ever know you are my heroes? You're everything I've ever searched for and everything I ever wanted to be. I fit, I belong, I'm snuggled in for life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And today, I believe with all my heart that every single one of us in this room, without exception, together, we can all soar like eagles because he's the wind beneath our wings. God bless you all and happy holidays.
Thank you so much for that, Bill. I've been looking forward to this. Taylor and I had to change months because I wanted Bill to come out, and my month is usually, I do this in November, and Bill had another engagement, and we worked it out because not only did I want to hear that story, I wanted him to share that story with you, so I'm glad you're all here tonight. Thanks again, Bill. Appreciate that.